The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Welcome to the second episode of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchen.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
In this episode, we speak to the New Zealand writer Megan Dunn, who most recently wrote Tinderbox, published by Gallibega Press. We met her at the launch of Tinderbox in London, but we actually spoke to her remotely once she'd returned to the Southern Hemisphere.
This was a really great conversation, and we covered quite a bizarre range of topics that we were not really fully prepared for when we started. We talked about Megan's background in art and art criticism, and how that led her to write and publish Tinderbox, which combines elements of non-fiction and fiction.
She spoke to us a little bit about looking people in the eye once you've used them in your own fiction, I guess. And another thing that she covered was National Novel Writing Month and using that as a motivation for getting your first long piece of work finished.
We also talked about literary fiction and how it's mainly aimed at people who are interested in staring at puddles, which is explained a little bit more detail later in the podcast.
We also learned a little bit about professional mermaids.
With the mermaids, I'll let myself go batshit mental.
I think we should give a shout out to any professional mermaids who've chosen to listen to the podcast. So thank you for joining us.
And so without any further ado, we'll go straight into episode 2 of Unsound Methods with Megan Dunn.
I was wondering if we could just sort of ask you about your start was in writing and how long you've been working at it.
Oh, God. Yeah, all right. How do I answer that one? Well, I suppose when I moved to London I moved to London in 2001, and I was at that time in my late 20s, and I had been a visual artist in New Zealand. I was actually a video artist. I made things on actual videotape. And then I moved to London in my late 20s and just had to rebuild my life over, and found myself with no money, and writing costs no money, but it does cost a shitload of time. So that was when I started really writing, trying to write fiction, trying to write my own stuff. I'd already done some writing because I'd started reviewing art in New Zealand before I left. And then it was just a really, really long, painful incubation process, which I'm still not entirely sure is over.
And it sounds as though it was a fairly similar sort of impetus for the sort of expression through video art or through writing. It sounds almost a practical decision based on the circumstances to sort of shift into writing as opposed to anything
particularly
stylistic.
I'd always loved books, and, of course, we all, so many of us do. So that had always been there, and I'd always been kind of gung-ho in my own mind, if nowhere else. I'll write a children's book by the time I'm 25 was one of the things I told myself. Well, I still haven't done that. I mean, hello, it's probably never going to happen. But the type of writer I thought I'd be is radically different to where I've ended up. I guess I hoped I'd be like Margaret Atwood or someone who I admired, but I've ended up being a far more curious, marginal creature than that. So it's probably been a while to reconcile what works for me. And, that can change project to project. But, yeah, there were some practicalities involved. There was just that huge human thirst to do something, to make something. Yet how, for who, and writing is one of those things that you can start in a very solitary way with absolutely no money.
And with Tinderbox being the sort of debut novel, I guess we should slightly talk about the form of it in a second, but I assume that isn't the first thing that you'd written. To sort of completion, but formally it's very interesting, and you deal with I guess it's National Novel Writing Month, isn't it? I don't quite know which nation they're. I mean, I guess that's the American The Americans set it up, maybe?
I assume it started in America. Yeah. I assume, but I would need to go and check the website. But yeah, it's very much a global online community. I mean, I'm sure it's Western dominated. But, you know, they have little factions in New Zealand. You can go to, National Writing Novel Month is as simple as signing onto this online site and trying to write a 50,000-word novel in a month. And it charts your progress. You know, it gives you little graphs of your day-to-day progress and gives you that deadline that so many of us so desperately need when we're, you know, doing everything else in our lives. So I signed up and, you can actually be quite social on it. And I wasn't, I was not remotely social. I could have gone to the Wellington Library and met up with other people who were doing it, but I didn't. I just pitted myself against it at home, trying to get to the daily word counts.
But I guess that's kind of the joy of it, isn't it? If you want to do it as a way of going and meeting some like-minded folk while you happen to try writing that amount of words, and that's fair enough, but as a way of having a strong deadline for quite a large number of words to complete in a month, I think, really, isn't it? 50,000. You deal with that quite a bit in the book, and the unique stresses that brings to your life. But I think that's sort of you can choose to take it one way or the other. So you speak about how you tried to write a kind of reinterpretation of Ray Bradbury's book. Was that because you needed a foundation from which then to develop a piece from, or what was the thinking behind that?
Well, I wrote a first novel, and we tried to sell it in 2009. My agent at the time and I, at the time, and I worked for Borders, the book chain where I'd worked for a long time, and Borders was being liquidated at the same time as, I think overall the whole publishing environment and bookselling environment was in flux and feeling challenged at that time. And it didn't sell, and I lost my job on Christmas Eve. it was just a bit of a shit time, the old Morrissey line, I can laugh about it now, but at the time it was terrible. And so I guess a few years, on from that, I was wanting to write another long prose work to completion. And so I thought, hey, I know what would be a great idea. I've been thinking about Fahrenheit 451 ever since the liquidation of Borders, thinking about that future of a world without books. And, he wrote that in one spirit, and I'm now thinking of it in another. Let's try and reinterpret his vision of the future, but from the perspective of the female characters in his story, who are, the minor characters. He has a major protagonist, Guy Montag, the fireman. So I was putting Montag into the background and putting the two female characters, Clarice and Mildred, Montag's wife, Clarice, the young, hot neighbour, I was bringing them forward. But doing it at that velocity of National Novel Writing Month just meant it was constantly going off the rails. And I was very aware that what I was writing had just one tone or texture to it, and that it was quite farcical. And that troubled me. So I didn't think it worked it just simply didn't work. It did not work as a sustained prose piece. And, so I just flagged it and, left it on the desktop. And it was a couple of years later that I was doing a non-fiction course on a day off from my full-time job and, thought, the guy who took that course is a great New Zealand based writer, Harry Ricketts. He's actually a British person, and he was like, well, what do you want to write about? And I was like, well, I want to write Fahrenheit 451 from the perspective of the female characters. And he's like, well, why don't you do that? And I'm like, well, I did, and it was terrible. And he was like, well, write about that. And so that's how Tinderbox started.
Did you redraft the bits from the original novel that you've used in Tinderbox, or are they kind of pretty accurate reflections of what you'd
ended up with?
I have redrafted them, and I've redrafted them partly because of the strand, you know, that kicks in at the end, which is that originally the draft Gally Beggar saw had parts of my attempt at the novel, you know, pitted against this non-fiction strand of me working at Borders and that trajectory. And, you know, the Bradbury Estate banned me for, you know, they wouldn't give me permission to write as his characters.
They were uncomfortable with it. Which is a hell of a euphemism.
Exactly. Yeah, they were uncomfortable. And I mean, you know, like instantly when I had to show it to them, I could see why they would be uncomfortable. You know, I really ended up in territory I wasn't expecting to cover. And I ended up being more ambivalent about his book than I'd, you know, I knew I wasn't writing fan fiction, but at the same time, I didn't know that I was going to end up taking such a devil's advocate position with his text until I did it.
So is that their objection quite important to the form that you ended up with, or is that quite a lot further down the line that you found they were resistant?
Well, I had already written I'd written a full draft. I mean, it's a short book anyway, but I'd written a full draft where it was alternating between these two major strands, me working in a bookstore and then, you know, me writing as Bradbury's characters in the future of Fahrenheit 451, where books are burned instead of read. And, you know, so I wrote the whole draft that way and then showed it to a few agents and to Gally Beggar a little bit down the track, who wanted to take it on and publish it, and then we found we couldn't because the Bradbury Estate blocked it on the copyright grounds. And of course, I don't have any commercial heft to push back against that. I didn't even know if I wanted to push back against that. I mean, I felt terrible that they were uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, at one level, I felt, oh yes, I'm uncomfortable about it as well, I felt. But I think the spirit of that original draft is very much maintained in this completed draft. But what it did mean was a book that was already bloody complex just got even more complex as I tried to find ways to keep it authentic, but to rewrite it in a full non-fiction mode instead of half non-fiction and half fiction, which is what the original was. If that even makes sense. This all just sounds like... I feel like I'm a cat playing with the ball of wool in front of me.
But that's a territory that you enter, because I would not hesitate to refer to it as a novel, to be honest, but I think it's... Obviously, you feel that it's
everyone
a piece of non-fiction.
Everyone calls it a novel.
Yeah, and I don't...
Well, they've published it as non-fiction. I kind of simultaneously feel that it's all true, and yet also that it's the most artificial thing I've ever written.
Yeah, it's a really... It's obviously a grey area, and I'm sure there's reams of academia that sort of deal with it. But, yeah, I don't... Just because it's largely about things that have happened... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to define a novel anymore. I think, you know... It gets too...
Yeah,
heavy.
Well, yeah, true.
And do you think that that's now the path that you're interested in taking and in using a similar approach to deal with other things?
You know, like, yes, but forever? I mean, who can say, you know? At the moment, for the past year, I've been interviewing professional mermaids online from all around the world because I was approaching, you know, I was going to write the great mermaid novel of the Western canon. You know, forget Hans Christian Andersen, like, who's he? I was going to cover the territory. But then I found that, you know, I was just kind of like, but really, there are all of these people who are working as mermaids. And so that, you know, that desire to find out about them has pushed the idea of it as a novel into the background. And then I enjoy the interaction of Skyping in with all of these mermaids and finding out about their world and what they're doing. But even as I say that, I'm not entirely unsold on the idea of writing a novel. in future.
And is the book that you're doing with the professional mermaids, which you've referred to a couple of times, as if that like, those two words are a regular combination of words? Is that...
They are for some.
Yeah, of course, of course. Is that a more straightforward non-fiction work, or is there still kind of more creative writing?
It won't be by the time I've finished with it.
But that's good. That's what makes it sort of vital and exciting, isn't it?
Oh, look, I don't think I could write you a straight mermaid book if I tried. Yeah, no. I mean, for years I've wanted to just be able to write a straight book, but sadly I just can't. I think, you can't deny what you are. It just kind of outs itself in the writing.
Talking of Tinderbox, you mentioned fiction and non-fiction blending together. Is that something you see in the process then? Or as you're writing, is it all sentence after sentence, you're not thinking whether this part's fiction or non-fiction? Is there a distinction there in your head during the process or afterwards? Or?
Obviously there are some things you can't fully remember, so you know I'm filling this in, I'm embroidering here, so I can't, entirely remember this moment or this sequence, minute for minute, so I know I'm elaborating, but already, it's cast into your memory, and that's a subjective area, and it's just one narrative take on it. I mean, I do think Tinderbox is a performance, like it's a performance of voice and tone and of gear shifting. And so I do think there's a lot of artifice in its construction in all of the sequences.
Do you have any decisions that... Did you sort of perhaps imagine a scene that happened in Borders which didn't take place, but you think, oh, that would work in the novel, I'm going to add that in, even though it wasn't a subjective experience you'd lived through?
I didn't. All of the stuff that I've written as Borders happened. Some of the time spans and the way I've framed it, I've shortened, I've accelerated things for the sake of... the reader's interest, ideally to keep people involved. But no, everything that I've written happened, because you have to, I haven't made up those scenes. I have made up book-selling scenes before in other works. I'm very adept at it, and I'm deeply attracted to it. I find I can write about people in bookshops all the time. Like, I quite enjoy it. But no, they're all true. But then, of course, there are other things I've completely made up in it. Like,
there are parts in it, though, where you're unflinchingly honest, I guess would be a way to put it. And I found that very interesting. It's something I've always thought with dealing with real people in real places in fiction, that it's maybe cowardice that wants to bring in some kind of plausible deniability or some way of obscuring the real person you're dealing with, lest they be grossly offended by it. But you actually you don't mince your words about quite a lot of people in that. Was that how you've always felt? You're just very happy with that?
I thought I was pretty kind about people generally. Who are you thinking of?
I think there's a couple of people in management positions who you felt didn't.
Oh, yeah, sure. But everyone hates their manager, don't they? Like, at least 90% of people hate their
absolutely,
manager.
But sort of committing it to print. I don't know, I think it's admirable. And I think, I guess it's good.
I hope that they'll just be pleased to be in my book. Look, I seriously doubt any of them will ever read it, And, they're just there for a moment. Like, really, there were relationships in Tinderbox that I could have totally laboured or gone into, and I haven't. And there were worse events that had happened to me, and people who really annoyed me. And, people who I really annoyed. I think I was pretty mild overall. But what can I say? I am a Kiwi. I'm a little bit more gauche, I think. I did used to come up against that a little bit when I lived in Britain. It's hard to say, isn't it? Like, what drives the novelist, and then what drives the non-fiction writer? I did have a sequence where I wrote about, you know, fiction and non-fiction as being like single beds in the same room, and I was thinking about, in Bradbury's book, Montag the fireman and his wife actually sleep in single beds in the same bedroom. And I think, you know, I thought that was quite a nice analogy for the relationship between fiction and non-fiction too.
I saw the time approaching when I would be left alone of the party of unsound method. The pilgrims looked upon me with disfavour.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this episode of the podcast. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Method, or check out our website, www.unsoundmethods.co.uk.
Borders was in many ways just a job to me, but when you lose that job after years, you're like, oh my God, how do I make a living doing something that I'm vaguely okay with? You know, it is a reasonably common question of our time. Admittedly a first world problem, but not exclusively first world.
I was wondering if we could talk to you about the process that you use for writing, if we can go back to the productive side of things. So at the moment, for example, you're working on your new books. So what stage are you at with that, and how do you go about pulling the information together and then deciding on the form?
Yeah, it's always long, protracted and kind of hard. I'm very much still in a research phase, but I have started writing. And I've realised I've probably got enough research to begin writing. Like, I wanted to get to a certain mermaid head count before I started writing. And, you know, one mermaid begets another mermaid, begets a merman, but, you know, it goes on and on. And each unfolds something different, as well as the fact that they're all unique people. The form hasn't completely evolved to me yet. I do see a relationship already with Tinderbox, but it's funny, for someone who doesn't, you know, I don't feel like I'm a maestro. I don't feel like I'm someone who can really shape-shift radically between different forms. Yet I find myself resistant to the idea of repeating the same format. And Tinderbox was conceived of as sparks, like you're always trying to, you know, strike a new match. And I hope that comes across in the format, in the little helpful flame insignia that I've inserted between passages. etc. And I need to find something different for however the mermaid book will evolve.
And on a sort of practical note, as you're sort of in the research phase, are you sort of writing notes? Are you sort of recording Skype conversations? Is yes. there a transition? Is there a clear point when you go from a collection of notes to starting page one, or does it sort of organically from the notes?
I assure you there is never a clear point. There's never a clear point, and there never will be. I record all of the interviews. I haven't even transcribed them all. I kind of need to mull things over, and then I will start writing at some point, because eventually the guilt will become too much about not writing. I do a combination of, storming and splurging out some stuff, because that's the only way I can get to surprise myself. And then I'll start to harvest and refine that. I do tend to sentences crazily, like they're little bonsais, you know. A lot of effort into that, but even that amuses me. I mean, isn't there some online course by John le Carré, and he says forget the sentence, think about the story. Well, this is why I'm in this nebulous area of literary fiction, because, you know, I just can't get the story, but I can't forget the sentence. You know,
and do you start at the beginning when you sort of storm and splurge into certain areas? Is it at random throughout the story, or are you sort of fairly methodical in following some sort of narrative arc or some sort of...
I'm not methodical, not at all. And I do find when you're working on a long prose work, you do need to do a little bit of advanced planning, I think, even if you're not a planner, because things will just go absolutely haywire, you know, if you, yeah, things can just go crazy. So one of the good things about using Fahrenheit as the most notational structure in the end was that I knew it had three sections, so I divided Tinderbox into three sections. I took the first sentence of every section and I used that as the first sentence for the beginning of each of my three sections. That's, you know, that process has changed a little bit with time. But I find middles quite difficult, and I did find the middle the most difficult part of Tinderbox, yeah.
It seems that...
I don't know if I'm helping or hindering this interview process.
No, absolutely. With the... You say you sort of tend to the sentences, and I think Le Carre saying that about story, he's probably being a little bit disingenuous, maybe, because his sentence structure seems to be as important. I guess it's a way of unblocking people just fiddling around the sentence. You said...
Maybe it's not John Carrey. Maybe it's someone else called John. I'm not... Maybe it's Lee Child.
Uh-huh.
People love Lee Child.
They do. That's it.
People love John Le Carre, but, I mean, New Zealand has a huge contingent of Lee Child readers. They freaking love this dude.
And was it Jodie... J.D. Pico, who you were saying, yeah, there's not. Is she also big in New Zealand as well? Did you have to return to that?
She was massive in Britain, massive during the, you know, when the Richard and Judy show first came and established itself. It was big, you know, in the mid 2000s. That Richard and Judy book club on TV. I don't know if you guys saw it, you know. But Jodie Picou was one of the first books I think they did. And then, you know, she's an I think she's an American or Canadian writer, and she had a huge back catalogue that was then brought, you know, started being brought over into print in Britain. And people were just mad for these things. I have nothing against poor Jodie. I say poor Jodie. She's mega successful. I've never even read her. But there's just something about... I don't know, there's just something when you're selling books and people are always buying the same book, just an incredible contrariness kicks in when you're the retailer of that item.
It's also you start to, I don't know, on this podcast, I don't want to speak ill of any writers because, yeah, everyone's
no,
really trying to, but we were speaking to Neil Griffiths yesterday about this and he was saying, and it's something I really agree with, it's just really, really fucking hard to write a book and it takes a long time and a lot of effort. And I think once there is a production line and things are being churned out at a suspicious rate of knots, you feel that maybe all the care and attention that might be given is perhaps not being given. Or maybe people have an amazing work ethic and they can just turn things around that quickly. But
I think people, we still have a huge degree of superstition and magical thinking around the arts and around writing. And deep down in me, I believe that there is genius, and some people have it and some people, you know, not so much. And so I think, you know, for people who are just amazingly successful, it's a little bit like, I'll have what she's having, you know, how do they do it? So I don't think it's all like a suspicion from the dark side. I think some of it's, you know, wanting to have whatever is fueling these writers that just seem to be able to do things, produce worlds, build books that people love so effortlessly, you know, effortlessly, you know, when you're watching from the outside. But I will say, working in retail, I don't know if either of you have ever worked in retail, but yeah, there was just something about selling the same book all the time that when I was in the bookstore, you know, and people would always, we went through the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo phase, people were always like, have you read it? You have to read it. And, you know, I would just always feel like, no, I don't have to read it. You're all But now that I'm outside it, I'm much more suggestible. You know, I'm not working in a bookstore now, and I'm much more suggestible to if someone says, hey, this is a great read, you've got to read it. I tend to think, oh, yeah, it probably really is.
With the, just going back to the, sort of the sentence structure and things, I wanted to ask about this, because you mentioned about it being a kind of performance earlier. And I think having seen you give the reading last week at your launch, the voice that came through is actually really incredible for Tinderbox. I'm really glad to have seen you read it beforehand. I obviously can't compare with not having that knowledge, but I think just reading the book, it is just written in such a strong voice. Is that something that you were kind of working on from the beginning when you were fiddling with the sentences? Is that just the kind of your internal monologue as it is, or is that something that you've had to work on? And have you had to read the entire draft out loud to get that flow?
I very much read aloud when I write it. I very much read aloud, you know, even in my own head. That's just writing 101, though, isn't it? Like, we all do that. And, I do. That is important to me, and I will read it out to my partner, as I said, during the launch in my speech, or, it wouldn't have to be him, but as soon as I read it aloud just to someone else, I will pick up something else that I won't pick up alone, something that's not working, something that doesn't sound right. So I do ear parts that I'm not sure of. In many ways, the voice is quite natural for me. I wouldn't say it's completely me, because, we all have different nuances, to our entire self and who we are in the quiet of our own mind, even as we stare blankly at a, mobile phone screen. But the voice is pretty naturally me. And, one of the questions that you kind of sent me in advance made me think about that. The voice is pretty naturally me. And when I write nonfiction, I actually feel slightly more relaxed. So when I did a very early draft of this, I was doing a nonfiction class, just a second year paper, taking time out from my full-time job. And, I wrote it, just with reading it to the class in mind. And as I was writing it at home in front of the TV to meet this particular deadline, I was chuckling away to myself, thinking, God, this is going to be a bloody wild ride for them all when I bring this up. I thought it was quite, I was feeling a little amused about that. And so when I brought it to the class and I read it out, I could instantly hear, that's a little bit boring at the start of it. I'll have to change that. And then as I got into it, it was like, it was going okay. And then I stopped the reading of this very short segment, early segment, and the whole class was silent. And then I was like, oh, my God, this has gone one of two ways. And then one guy just went, that was amazing, and I knew it had gone the right way. And, if I hadn't had that from the class, I probably wouldn't have kind of kept going with it in some way, because I was aware, like, writing this, one of my biggest angsts has been, God, this is totally meta. Why am I writing a postmodern novel in, the ascendant of modernism? Why am I doing this? Why can't I write something, more like Margaret Atwood? I was aware it was a very meta proposition, and one night when I was explaining it to my boyfriend, I was like, it's kind of like Adaptation, the movie. And my boyfriend looked at me and went, but you hate Adaptation. And I went, I know. But somehow, that first airing of an early draft of it made me see how the different components of what I'd done, like from Borders to the failed draft of Fahrenheit 451 that was just too farcical as a piece in and of itself, made me see how together it all actually became something really quite funny and lively.
I think it's definitely that it's metafictional in the right way, because it comes from a place of sincerity and a way of solving the problem of bringing that material together. I think the reason that very postmodern novels can often get people's backs up is because they feel sometimes like someone started with the decision that they wanted to produce something postmodern and then have sort of gone in that direction. Feels very forced, sure. I think.
Yeah, sure. I do feel like the book is totally like something who went to art school, you know, something that somebody who went to art school in the 90s would have made. You know, like the films I made when I was at art school, I used to go to the local video store and I would rent mainstream Disney films. I would rent things like Splash and Labyrinth, films I'd loved as a child, and then I would take them into an edit suite because none of them were, you know, copyright protected at that point, the VHS tapes, and I would just recut them into new, you know, new avant-garde movies of my own making, little miniature things. So I've actually been messing around with other people's copyrights for years, and it's funny how no matter what I do, I can't quite seem to get away from it. That impetus is always there. I did feel like Tinderbox, I do think Tinderbox is very authentic at the same time as being utterly artificial, of course. But yeah, I did feel like I've been honest about something here. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there doing, you know, wanting to write things. I suppose one of the driving questions that I was a bit subconscious about when I did it was, do you have to be a genius to want to write a work of literature? And I think, you know, Tinderbox, you know, is surveying mediocrity, you know, no time to even read the novel that you're trying to rewrite, no time to write a novel, and looking at all of the shortcut techniques that we, you know, we do as human beings and seeing what I could make from that.
But I think also that it's good for people who feel very constrained and people who want to write. I'm not in any way suggesting that it's something everyone can do and that it's easy, but if people are feeling very constrained, they have this idea of a kind of the 19th century novel that they've grown up with, they're trying to write, and maybe they embark on something like National Novel Writing Month to do that, they're probably going to fail. But I think if you look at something like Tinderbox and structurally how it's put together, I think that might open up people to just, yeah, more alternative forms that they could use to bring ideas together.
Yeah. And you also write sort of more criticism and sort of non-fiction in that format as well. Is there, do you see any? Is there a sort of any distinction between writing an essay of criticism and sort of working on the mermaids?
Yes.
Novel or book, really?
Yes, there is. Because with the mermaids, I'll let myself go batshit mental, but I won't do that with the criticism in the same way. You know, it just depends on where the criticism's going to. But I still need somewhere where I can go completely feral.
And is that from your sense of the whichever publication or wherever you're sending the criticism? You have a sense that if I go batshit crazy in this, it's not going to get published? Or is it because you feel that essay or that piece, it won't benefit from going crazier?
I think you've still got to do, like, you got to do what it says on the tin a little bit still with criticism. I mean, there is huge scope within that, and God only knows people write amazing criticism, and that's one of the main things I read now, as well as children's picture books. But I think you've still got to say where's up and where's down. And yes, it is dictated a little bit by the type of publication it's for. So some I'll go more far out with than others. But yeah, I still need scope, you know, guys. I still just need to be me, you know.
Which is, I can imagine a similar sort of approach working with a lot of criticism work, a lot of pieces. You could sort of incorporate those more subjective experiences and work it into something quite interesting in the way you've done with Tinderbox.
And I do, and I think Tinderbox did end up being strangely a kind of work of criticism in a way, like of both Bradbury's book and of Truffaut's movie of Bradbury's book. It has ended up being a kind of critical work.
Do you think then if somebody, making, if you had a publishing deal and a contract and a deadline to deliver the Mermaid book by, you know, February, would that change the way you write? Would that change the sort of day-to-day practicalities of writing and also what form and style it to?
I think Or someone make me an offer and then we'll see, huh? I think, you know, the experience of the first unsold novel was probably something where I, you know, I do remember saying to the agent I had at the end of that process, you know, I feel like we're just before the wedding and the dress still doesn't fit. And when are we just going to say this dress isn't going to fit for the wedding and we're going to do another one? You know, it's really bad that about the publishing scene and agents, I end up having, you know, weird romantic metaphors, and I don't think that's a good thing. I feel like I compromised myself and was more confused about what I could or would produce with the first book. Tinderbox, I knew I was writing something specious and delightful, and then I sent it to some agents, not expecting anyone was going to tell me, oh my God, let's call Penguin immediately, you know. But I felt like there is some readership out there for this. And then I struck gold with Gally Beggar, who were the right people to find the natural readers for this work. And I suppose with the Mermaid book, yeah, I feel, I think... Yeah, it's. I don't want to go back to the place I ended up in with the first one. I want to write something that takes me somewhere wild, somewhere I don't completely know I'm going to go, and yet I still want to be able to bring that into a form where I can take other readers with me. There is a little bit of a risk. Like, I have been thinking, how would I frame this as a proposal to a publisher? And yeah, then all of this weird kind of thinking does start to, you know, infect my imagination a bit of like, oh, write chapters. And then I'll be like, God, how do I even write a chapter? I don't even know, you know. I don't know if that makes sense to you. But, when I'm saying I want to write a mermaid book, I mean, you know, I want to go absolutely mental.
And what do you?
And I will.
What do you?
God
do you
knows
feel? By going mental at it, I guess you're trying to sort of push some sort of boundary somewhere within the sort of framework of whatever the book turns out to be.
Yes, I guess, you know, going mental about mermaids makes sense to me, but does that make sense to anyone else? I guess it's just trying to take the mermaid motif to some places where it's not already commonly placed. And so that's trying to look at, you know, different sources of information about mermaids and to mash them all together. I mean, already I've been doing that because, you know, when I was first approaching this idea as a fictional novel, I had a mermaid protagonist, you know, turning up in a town. And I was using as a motivation for this book an image I'd found in an anthology of mermaid stories. And it was a kind of 1970s-ish looking illustration of a mermaid sitting in a fishmonger's, sitting on all of the laid out fish on the ice with a big fat kind of, you know, fishmonger burly guy, Benny Hill looking guy behind her, but a beautifully drawn illustration. And so as I started shifting this idea into a non-fiction realm, I thought, right, who did that illustration? And so I found the illustrator, Pauline Allison, who's a woman now in her 70s, a British illustrator, and I've contacted her, I've interviewed her, I've found out where that mermaid image was originally, who that was produced for, and then I've realised that she did the covers for some Ursula Le Guin, you know, the Earthsea series, you know, yeah. So this is what I mean. You, as soon as you start moving with an idea and you start putting it out there into the non-fiction realm, the rest of the world starts pushing back, and you know, all of this information comes to light, and then it's up to me to try and give it a form where it can start to mean something altogether. Right now, guys, I have no idea what that means. But I love those moments.
What do you feel fiction should be doing, or good fiction, when it hits the mark? What is it doing that other forms of expression or other modes of being for humans, so it's not achieving.
I do feel like literary fiction, as much as it's maligned and, you know, kind of, you know, simultaneously defended for its allegedly small readership and then, you know, attacked for its whiteness and its middle classness, fear attacks certainly and on many counts. But I do feel like ultimately literary fiction is for people who are really into puddles. You know, what novels are really about are the breakaway moments where someone looks out at a trembling puddle and they have their little interior moment. And then, you know, I do think that novels take you inside those cutaways, and short stories as well, in ways that other forms don't. But, you know, film's really overtaken the place of the novel as a paramount expression, and now, of course, TV. I'm not sure, like, I could even definitively answer what I feel it gives, but I still need it. I still, you know, thirst for it, and I still like spending time with someone else's voice inside my head, and it can take me into things I relate to, and it can take me into experiences I've never had before and never will, and yet am still moved by. But, you know, that movement can be to laughter as much as it can be to, you know, sadness, depth of feeling, mm-hmm. you know.
Although I feel like the novel can... it makes the experience more yours, perhaps, than with film and TV. I know you can sort of use voiceover and things like that, but it's kind of intangible. But I still feel there's something unique the novel can do that TV and film can't really get close to.
Yeah, I think there is too. Like, one of the things I did before I came to London for my book launch, I went to Copenhagen and was part of an academic conference about mermaids and modernity. And one of the joys of that conference was being introduced to this Mark Segal book called Sailor Twain, or A Mermaid on the Hudson River. And it's a graphic novel, you know, actually like a chunky novel, but it's this amazing graphic work. And I just found it so moving, yet it tells a really compelling story. What I loved most about it, though, was not the story. It was the cutaways to all of his little pictures of the fish beneath the river and, you know, these amazing, you know, illustrative moments, sensory moments, but moments that also can convey feelings. They're kind of things that I love in literary and written novels too. And I guess as I've come away from looking at that book recently, I've been reflecting on how do I get this? How do I get this, you know, from the next book or books I write, and yet still tell a story that keeps you turning the pages to the end? Mm-hmm. You know, that's our biggest challenge, isn't
yeah.
it? And I mean, of course, it's not the same for everyone. There's no one fit size for everyone. And for instance, when I was little, my dad, of course, a huge reader, and I talk about that a bit in Tinderbox, but I totally remember him giving me Hemingway's, you know, The Old Man and the Sea to read when I was a teenager. And I was just like, I got about halfway through it. It's a short book. And I was like, is this really about a man and a fish? You know, I was incredulous. Like, how? What? Like, when's the love interest coming on? Where are the chicks? You know, what's going on? But, you know, I read that in my 20s many years later, and I absolutely loved it and found it utterly moving. And I also love the lions coming down. Like, he talks about, you know, the old man is watching the lions on the beach from his boat. But, of course, many people think, you know, Hemingway's an ass, and that work is totally sentimental. You know, maybe I should reread it again.
I suppose, yeah, sorry. Especially a work of that kind of brevity, it might be worth revisiting. I haven't read it for years.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he...
Did you get anything from it?
I was really taken with it. I didn't read it, I think, until I was about 28, maybe. So I think, yeah, if I was...
Mm.
There's some of those canonical books, the 20th century's important books, like Catcher in the Rye, for example, that I read it completely wrong. I read Catcher in the Rye as a 13-year-old, I guess, but in the 90s, and just thought, this is absolutely dreadful. This is the rebellious novel that you've told us all about. But maybe I would find something more in that if I'm back to it.
I do remember reading it in my library, and you know, like in high school, I remember reading a section of it, the section with the the song lyrics, is it? If somebody catch a body coming through the rye, and I remember reading that and thinking, what the heck is going on here? You know, like it was above my head, I think. But I always remembered it from then. I didn't read it till much later when I was an adult. But coincidentally, I do really love some of Salinger's short stories, like The Laughing Man and some of the stories in For Esme with Love and Squalor. Mm-hmm. Like I love more than Catcher. You know, some of them really have made me laugh my ass off.
I might have to go back and read the short stories.
Oh, yeah, there's a Tadalma Smith's, I can't pronounce it, Blue Phase, and it's about this young guy who's an artist. That story had me in fits the first time I read it. I mean, I probably oversold it to you already. That's the worst thing, right? But, I do love those. I guess with novels, you know, there is the wordplay, you know, the sound and the look of the words, and I think that means something, you know, to all of us who love reading. That means something and excites something in itself. You know, I'm flicking through Fahrenheit as I'm sitting here, and, you know, you could just take any part of it, and just the sound of his words, the little mosquito delicate dancing hum in the air, the electrical murmur of a hidden wasp snug in its special pink warm nest. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's special. It's special. That could be the new catchphrase for Bradbury's Fahrenheit. It's special, Megan Dunn. That's the cover quote. My God, terrible.
Thanks so much to Megan for joining us for a really illuminating and interesting chat. We hope you enjoyed it.
That was episode 2. Remember, you can find us on Twitter at Unsigned Methods or at unsignedmethods.co.uk.
We're also on all the usual podcasting channels. We should be by now, so please track us down. Listen, like, subscribe, all of that. Thank you for listening.
And we hope you'll join us in 2 weeks' time when we're back with another episode.